As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Cassidy rains as it gets wet, wet, wet in New York, New York. The Estacheta ends wind drought, but Jev's title hopes dry up. And what does the future hold for NYC Ypres? All this and more in the Race Formula E podcast, New York edition. Hello, I'm Andrew Vandenberg, and joining me today in the sweatiest podcast recording of the season, fresh from the hell of travelling through Heathrow Terminal 3 post-Brexit, is Sam Smith. And we're delighted to be joined by our special guest, none other than Jaguar Racing's title challenger, Mitch Evans. Mitch, great to have you on the show. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks. Good morning. Thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, Mitch, I promise we'll be with you soon. But Sam, we've got a lot to unpack, especially from that first race. Okay, firstly, let's talk about the finish and what happened when that flash flood hit the track.
Yeah, it all got a bit Takashi's Castle, didn't it? We just needed Craig Charles to pipe up with Nichols and Dario in the comms box. I mean, interestingly, just before the grid, I bumped into Porsche's Florian Modlinger, who was looking out towards the Hudson and Manhattan. And he said that he reckoned that there was some localized showers coming in. Actually, in the first 20 minutes of the race, they were delayed. They came a bit later, but Florian was convinced they were coming. And it was all a bit prophetic, really, as we saw this remarkable cloudburst. It was just the most insane thing. It was like a cartoon cloud had just sort of hovered above a section of the track and dumped a ton of water on it. I've never seen anything like it, really. I mean, the first to come upon it were the leading trio of Cassidy, Degrassi and Stoffel Vandoorne, and they just all aquaplaned straight off. There was a separate shunt behind between Wehrlein, who got rear-ended by Buemi's Nissan. It was just a massive mess. I mean, three of that five ended up in the turn six barriers, as we saw. It was just one of those accidents that make you flinch, really. Obviously, the main thing is the safety element. They all got away with it, but it wasn't necessarily the speed of the shunt. It was just the stop, really. You know, when there is that inevitability of an accident or other cars joining that carnage, there are some drivers there prone and exposed, particularly Cassidy, who got hit twice. I've seen similar shunts to that, one at Alton Park in British GT about 20 years ago, which frankly scared the hell out of me, and I was just spectating. So those kind of things are really, really, really dodgy when they happen. I think it was lucky that Vandoorne hit Cassidy sideways on. If that had have been gearbox first, it could have been really nasty for Nick. Thankfully, they're all okay. The strength of the Gen 2 cars came into their own there, which was good to see. But just wrong time, wrong place. And you also have to factor in as well, to some extent, that, you know, at that stage of the race, the tyres are worn a little bit more. And that you've got, you know, drivers were on their regen paddles as well. So the first three, just, you know, they were on the hiding to nothing. They were straight into the wall. Others made it through, and others got clobbered by some braking earlier than they thought, and just been incited by it. It was just an insane, intense, localized shower that created absolute merry hell out there.
Mitch, what was it like in the car? Because obviously we saw a few onboards, and it looked like, you know, you just got caught up on a wave and would take just aquaplaning off the track.
Yeah, it was mad. So I had my first taste of it coming through the last corner and in the previous lap, and I couldn't see anything. So I was going out to turn one. I was behind De Vries and a bunch of cars, and it was just like a wall of water, which was a bit scary. I managed to actually overtake De Vries into turn one somehow. And then just the way that, as Sam touched on, how isolated the shower was, it was just hovering around the circuit of, you know, where the last corner was and turn six and seven, where, you know, where the big shunt happened. But like turn one and two, three, four was actually, it was a little bit wet, but it was actually relatively dry. But it wasn't until we got to that back into the back straight where it got really, really nasty. So obviously Scott, the race director, decided to throw a four course yellow. But just the timing of where the guys hit the shower was just really unlucky. So for me, I was entering four course yellow, you know, during that phase of the track where the aquaplaning was really bad. And I actually got a penalty, and a few of us got penalties for not getting down to the speed to 50K, because we, you know, it was like almost impossible to break. So it was a bit of a harsh penalty because just because of the nature of the conditions. But yeah, we're a little bit lucky that we're a little bit further behind the front guys, because they obviously just got caught out massively, and it was a pretty nasty thing to watch back. Because at the time, I actually had no idea there was cars in the escape route. I couldn't even see cars down there. So until I saw after with the replays that they were all buried down there together. So bizarre situation, but luckily no one hurt.
Sam, we'll talk about harsh penalties in a second, but before then, the rain stopped as quickly as it came along, and the light was still good, and there was still time left. So why wasn't the race restarted?
Good question, this. Very good question. It's a question I asked Scott Elkins just after we knew that the race wasn't going to be restarted. I think in terms of a red flag, first of all, it was clearly obvious that that was probably the right call when you've got this this melee in the escape road. But before that, with the full course yellow, a few of the drivers I spoke to questioned that, and if actually a safety car wouldn't have been a better way to go. Elkin said that the full course yellow is the quickest way to stabilize a race in a dangerous situation, and that's correct. You know, it takes drivers have 5 seconds to get down to the required speed, whereas a safety car is a bit more involved, obviously, in terms of getting that procedure in place. But a full course yellow was the decision made, and then the red, the real fallout, which we'll come on to in shortly. But it was whether the race should have been restarted or not. That was the fundamental question. The rationale for not restarting was quite varied. Scott told me that actually, had the race have been restarted with, I think it was 7 minutes, 40 odd seconds and one lap to go, which is a significant time in a race of 45 minutes, of course. It's not as if there was 2 minutes left and no real point in having a one lap sprint to the end. He said that there would have been few actual racing laps anyway, because they'd have had to do a few laps behind the safety car. Presuming that they had a safety car start, which, you know, was the insinuation there. The Tech Pro was damaged but easily replaceable. Frankly, the track, from what I saw, dried incredibly quickly because it was just so warm there and the sun came out almost immediately. Scott was in consultation with the teams, and obviously some had a great deal to gain from not restarting, while others had a lot to gain. You know, there was that whole chestnut, of course. Ultimately, it's one man's decision, and that decision is informed by consultation with media, multiple people, and not the media, multiple people and different agencies there.
If only we had such power.
But, you know, personally speaking, I'd like to have seen it restarted. I think a lot of others, obviously, Jaguar TCS Racing would have wanted to see it restarted, because Mitch would have been in a good position. From Scott's point of view, you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't, I guess, in this situation, because if he had have restarted, then, you know, Envision, Merck and Venturi would have been mightily pissed off, but, you know, Jaguar would have been fairly happy about it. Ultimately, though, I always thought that a race would always try to be concluded. I mean, there is no time limit to finishing the race in the sense of restarting it. So why it wasn't restarted, you know, those reasonings, I found a little, you know, looking back, I actually found a little flimsy, if I'm honest. I think 7 minutes and a 7:40 and a minute and a lap to go is a reasonable amount of racing, I'd say, to restart an event. But actually, you know, it wasn't in the end. And, you know, I found that difficult. There was a lot of, I suppose, you know, inevitable conspiracy theories flying around about TV time and so forth. I asked Scott about that, and obviously he said that's never under consideration. You hope it wouldn't be for restarting a race. It seemed to be a combination of genuine safety concerns. But as I said, you know, I think a raceable track wasn't far off after that red flag situation. So a shame in a way, but then of course you've got the other argument of, well, you know, Cassidy and the front three are taken out by an act of God, and it goes back to the penultimate lap of the race, and from that point of view that's probably fair. So yeah, not an easy one to sort of make a final decision on. I just found the circumstances and the environment after the race very you know, was presentable to a conclusion of the race.
Mitch, I'm sure you were gagging to get back out there and conclude the race. Was your opinion sought by anyone?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as Sam touched on a few points there, like, you know, obviously I think they made the right call, red flagging the race after, you know, multiple cars, you know, making contact at, you know, pretty heavy impact. But, you know, as you know, Sam touched on with the weather, okay, we were red flagged for like 15 minutes. The rain had stopped completely. It was very hot, humid there. So the track was drying up very quick. There was no attempt to bring out the safety car to do some laps to see if the track was, you know, in a raceable condition. There was just nothing that jumped out that would, you know, there was no barrier damage. There was obviously tech pro, but that's easily replaceable. So you just try and go down the list of reasons why. Yes, the guys got unlucky, you know, that got caught in that weather. But, you know, I got unlucky, you know, a few of us got unlucky in qualifying when the rain came down. And, you know, what are we meant to do? Restart qualifying or, you know, cancel qualifying? I don't know. It just, with that amount of laps to go, 7 minutes left plus one lap, it just was too premature to end it, in my opinion. Obviously, I would have benefited from it, but just looking from a complete sporting point of view, I don't understand the call from them. So, obviously, very disappointing for us because we were going to salvage a really strong result with a few of my title rivals, you know, in the wars. So they were obviously able to salvage, you know, some good points. You know, obviously I think Nick, he deserved to win the race because, you know, in terms of, you know, he'd led the whole way and he was looking like he was probably going to win. So I'm happy that he got his first win, but, you know, I think as a full picture, it just seemed wrong, for them to do what they did. So, and the answers, the explanations seem very vague and just not really thought out. So, yeah, I heard even with the podium, you know, that was already, you know, the TV broadcasting, that wasn't even being broadcast because it was already past the broadcasting time. So,
oh yeah. On Eurosport, they just cut away. They were sort of dragging them onto it and then that was it.
Yeah. So, I mean, it just, like, imagine if you're a new fan, you're watching the race, you see the top, you know, the top guys buried in the wall, you know, obviously, you know, I'm not saying they could have avoided it, but they're obviously heavily damaged. And then, you know, 15 minutes later, they're spraying champagne. It's just like, that just seems wrong in my opinion. Okay, if it's a lap to go in different circumstances, okay, it's maybe a little bit different. But with the amount of time we had left, I think it was far too premature to make that call. So, yeah, strange one.
The irony of it was that it was such an early start to the race as well. It started at 1 o'clock local time. So it's not as if, you know, it's not as if it's a night race and there's curfews or there's pressures on that front. So yeah, I sort of share Mitch's surprise on that one. And I did find some of the reasons and rationale a bit on the flimsy side.
Some other things that drew some quizzical looks, Sam, were the subsequent penalties that came from it, because obviously those three cars were all heavily damaged, which required various components to be changed. Can you explain why somebody like Cassidy had penalties for battery changes, yet Van Dorn didn't?
I can try if we bolt on an extra 3 hours of the podcast. But so, yeah, the boring regulation bit, first of all. Each car gets two electric motor generators, MGUs, two gearboxes, two inverters, one battery pack, and you're allowed to have one survival cell for the entire season. Now, in that shunt, both Van Dorn and Cassidy's tubs were cracked, so they had to change to a new monocoque. Because that was a safety feature and the circumstances of the accident were taken into consideration, they did not take penalties for that. If you wreck your tub by being, you know, by making a mistake in qualifying or practice or the race, and then subsequently for the next race, if it's a double header, you will take a penalty. But because of the circumstances, the tub, there were no penalties for the tub. Now, for the Cassidy penalty, what seems to have happened is that Cassidy's battery casing was cracked after the impact suffered when Van Dorn hit him in particular. So they took a spare battery and a spare battery radiator. He'd already had a change at Riyadh after he shunted in practice. So therefore, letter of the law, took a penalty. Now, the more existential question, if you want, is should a driver who's been hit by another competitor in such extreme circumstances, which were taken into account by the FIA because of the chassis change, be penalised for a component change? That's a whole fresh debate. You know, that's something that I actually don't think is particularly fair. If you are saying in one accident, some parts of the car, it's okay, you don't get a penalty because of the circumstances, but the others you do. That's confusing at best, isn't it? And I think that certainly needs a look at. But sticking with the regs and facts for a moment, Van Dorn and Buemi, Buemi had some gearbox, some battery damage. They were offered spare batteries by McLaren Applied because they'd gone over the 15G tolerance when they were hit. There's a sensor which flashes up and they have to be looked at and changed. What isn't completely certain is how the pool of spare batteries was allocated on Saturday night. I'm told through Mercedes that they didn't use a spare unit in their car for Van Dorn, and therefore didn't take penalties. Nissan, I'm not absolutely sure. I've not got any clarity on Nissan, whether they used a spare or not. Envision did, and ultimately it was really hard on Envision, who subsequently petitioned the decision for that penalty. And it was only made public after Cassidy had got pole. Now, for me, that's problematic. And I think that's just another bad look for the championship, that Nick goes out, puts in that mega lap for his second pole, his third in total at New York, and then he's told live on TV that he's got the pole, that he's lost the pole, and he's pushed to the back of the grid. I mean, it was a hard watch, that. It was just pitiful, really. You know, Nick's made to look a bit daft as he's told that live on air. Intriguingly, the race had a part to play in the official petition, which was put in on Saturday night, or Sunday morning, rather. We acquired a film of the incident, thanks Hugo Morales, who's a friend of the show, and it clearly showed that Van Dorn caused the damage by sliding into Cassidy. That, in turn, that video was used as new evidence to the FIA in Envision's petition, which is allowable through an article of the International Sporting Code. That was subsequently thrown out, and Cassidy's heartbreak was compounded with the penalty. So he ended up at the back of the grid. Not only that, but because he couldn't take the penalty of 30 places, he then had to do a drive-through in the race. So, his whole day was written off. Even
30 places, he was starting from Manhattan Island, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was starting from Wall Street. And, I thought, a particularly wretched scenario in an incident which, you know, on one hand you're saying, oh, well, you know, there are circumstances and there are, you know, it was an act of God or whatever you want to call it. And then the next you're saying, well, the guy's actually got a 30-place grid penalty and his race is written off. But actually nobody knows it until he's qualified on pole. I mean, that isn't, in my mind, that isn't a good look for the championship at all. And, was a whole big mess.
What was a good look, though, was that race-winning drive from Cassidy in that first race. You know, he's had a tough season, maybe not had a great deal of luck, but that was a very impressive performance, Ham.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, he did a fantastic job. And, you know, Nick's had one of those seasons where he's been, you feel as though he is on the cusp of something big. But we've been saying that for two seasons, and it's never quite happened. Hasn't always been his fault. In fact, most of the time, it isn't his fault, it's your circumstances. He's mega at Red Hook. You know, he got a pole last season, he got a podium last season. He's just really good around there. They had the Envision Racing team had a big regrouping after Marrakesh. They'd had these three races, Berlin, Marrakesh and Jakarta, where they just, you know, they were also Rams. They've had lots of engineering changes in that team this season. And it's, I think there's some short term pain and hopefully long term gain for what they're building there. But, you know, they did come under some fire by us and others after Marrakesh, because it was the third event where they just didn't turn up. And they've never had that before. Envision have always been, and Envision Virgin, as they were known, have always been a force. You know, they've always been in the, with a chance of a podium at least, if not victory. And that, you know, they were just lower midfield at those three races. So Nick fought back. I think he's shown pace and potential, as I said, this season. It all came together in New York, and he was just on it. You know, even in the rebuilt car, he said to me on Sunday that even in that car, which was completely rebuilt for Sunday, he just felt so on it that, you know, there was no question in his mind that he wasn't going to start from pole. Unfortunately, as we've discussed, that was taken away from him. But I think when he reviews and appraises what he achieved at the weekend, I think he can be pretty proud, and he can actually be very positive looking forward to the last two events in London and Seoul, because I think, you know, they're going to be the Audi's final races of the season, of the championship. Sorry, it's the last time we're going to see an Audi racing in the championship, and I think they've got a very good chance of getting in the mix and, you know, just disrupting and disturbing the title battle, because they, if they achieve what they did in New York, they're, you know, they're potential winners for sure.
Mitch, was it nice to see a fellow Kiwi up on the top of the podium?
100%. Look, I've grown up with Nick. I've known Nick since I was six, back in Mount Wellington Go-Kart Club in Auckland. And yeah, we've both come a long way, and he's obviously achieved some amazing stuff, you know, throughout his career, and obviously a lot in Japan. And, you know, he obviously entered formally and made an impression straight away, but that first win is always so difficult to achieve. And he's come close, you know, as you guys touched on, you know, last year in Red Hook, he came very close to victory. So, it's, you know, for him to obviously, you know, get two poles and his first victory was great to see. So, yeah, I think there's been a big turnaround with that team, and, you know, they were definitely probably the benchmark over the course of both days in New York. So I'm expecting big things for the remainder of the season with them.
Now, Mitch, we can't have you on this show and not talk about that incredible fight that you had with Nick de Vries, but more importantly, that save, which I think is probably the best save I've ever seen, when you went down the inside, hit the bump, got thrown completely sideways, yet somehow kept out the barrier. Sam, we might even call it Gordon Banks-esque, one for the Zoomers there. what was it like from you behind the wheel? I guess it all happened in a blink of an eye, didn't it?
Yeah, massively. I just got, well, going back a little bit, I actually just got overtaken by him in a way that, you know, I've obviously publicly come out and said that I wasn't impressed by the move. He was told to try and overtake me as soon as possible, obviously to try and help Stoffel. And just the way he did it, I really wasn't impressed about. And then so I was not best pleased behind the wheel. And so I wanted to get back past him as soon as possible, because I felt like I had, you know, some serious pace to offer. And you know, it was, yeah, then I opted to have a little crackdown into turn six, but the pothole that I made good friends with came by unfortunate surprise. And, yeah, actually, initially I just thought, like, what the hell is going on? Like, just try and gather the car up. But initially I thought I'm going down the escape route, because it's the way the car wasn't really decelerating. Once it actually obviously made contact with the ground again, I was locked up, and I thought, oh, you know, I'm heading down the escape route, and I'm going to be reversing back up and losing all these positions. But then the more I got to the escape route, I thought, no, I've got this. I can gather it up, and I just try to get as much speed out of the car. And then the next phase was like, okay, who the hell's behind me? Is anyone coming up behind me that, you know, will I keep my position? Then I noticed there was a bit of a gap, so I thought, no, we've got this. It's all good. And then got out of turn six and seven, and I think every each one of my tires was like a 50 pence piece. So that was so I might have to go and see the dentist. But yeah, it was just a wild moment that just caught me by like a huge surprise. But yeah, it looked good. I don't want to do it again.
I was going to say, have you watched it? Have you watched the video of it?
I watched it a few times, and I don't really want to do that again. But it was it's made for good, some good highlight reels and some social content. But let's not try and repeat that. That was just with how it caught me by surprise. It was pretty horrible. But yeah, then obviously DeVries had exactly the same thing as me, almost like copy and paste a few laps later. So it was like, and then you look back and you think, you know, how was that pothole like not being seen by, you know, the track inspections as well? So,
well, that was going to be my next question, because surely when you do the track walk or whatever, it must have been significant to make a car go that far in the air.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be completely honest with you. Like, it wasn't really an area that I, you know, caught me by surprise. Obviously, you look at stuff that's on the sort of racing line, different potholes. We had a few drain covers out of turn 4 and 5. And you always have sort of, you know, these things with our street tracks we race on, but just where the position of that particular pothole was so, you know, so close to, inside barrier. I don't think anyone probably realized how severe it was and how deep it got, but, I think in the future it just needs to be looked at, you know, in depth, you know, 'cause obviously, yeah, it's not a track, it's not a part of the track we drive on every lap, but, you know, potentially, as we see, you can, you know, we try and utilize as much as these, you know, the Formula tracks, you know, once we're racing each other, because they're quite tight. So I think, yeah, just hopefully going forward, it's a bit of a lesson for the FIA to be able to, you know, scope out some of these, you know, obviously some potholes are totally fine to run over, but ones like that aggressive, we need to learn from.
No, Sam, I think it's fair to say on a few occasions on this show, we've talked about how Lucas Degrassi's qualifying pace was sort of undermining his race performances, but he turned back the years for race one and missed out on pole by absolute whisker.
Yeah, he did. He was much improved in terms of qualifying pace over the weekend, and he headed Mortara on merit really for the first time this season. Although Edo had a brake by wire issue on Sunday in qualifying. Lucas led for a short time in Saturday's race, and like Cassidy and Van Dorn, was on the podium despite being in the boonies at Team Turn 6. He was unlucky on Sunday, as there was a catastrophic team error in that they didn't get him in the qualifying session. They got caught out by the minimum time rule for the quali group, and he only started 18th on the grid, and then he had that shunt with Vern, which, you know, incidentally, that gained Mortara a point, who got 10th at the end of that. I thought Degrassi was actually lucky not to get a penalty for that. When you look at it, he squeezed Vern substantially on the exit on the right-hander, and also took out an innocent Oliver Askew. So, you know, quite what you have to do to get a penalty sometimes, you know, that's another question for another time. I think overall it was Degrassi's most competitive showing, I think, as a package, as a sort of double header for Venturi this season. We know he's only going to be there for one season. He's going to be heading off to Mahindra for next season. He was good at London last season as well, in that infamous Lucas loophole, copyright VDB on that one. So I could see him having a really strong end to the season, which is ironic as it's going to be his final races for Venturi. The big question then is, you know, will he be able to help Mortara in his quest to be world drivers champion? That's, you know, that's one of the big questions, I think, heading into the last two races, and a topic we discussed in the last podcast with Ian James, didn't we? So yeah, but all round, you know, if he qualifies well, the grass is in there, and as we know, when he's, you know, when Degrassi is in a fight, he comes out punching, and he did so on Sunday, and came out without a glove being laid on him by the stewards again. So there you go. All very interesting.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. you can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
Mitch, the big change this year from previous seasons is the qualifying format, and I think we all acknowledge that that's given us this fantastic championship where we've got, well, it was four, maybe now three main contenders. But I'm interested from a driver's perspective how it's changed how the weekends work. Do you spend, now that qualifying is so important, do you spend a lot more time working on quali setups? How does it differ from previous seasons?
Yeah, it's changed things a lot in the approach to practice sessions. The run plans have changed quite a bit in combination with, you know, having shorter practice sessions as well. Our FP1 now is only 30 minutes, not 45. So just that 50 minutes difference changes things a lot to try and prepare for the day. The thing is, like, to try and divide up, you know, push laps at different powers and also race, you know, energy management laps is really difficult because, you know, we've seen in the races how important to have, you know, the energy management under control. Some of these last races with the battery temp management as well. And in combination of that, you know, obviously we've got a whole new qualifying format where we don't just get one shot at it anymore. We get, you know, obviously 12 minutes to do, you know, what we want. So that normally, you know, entails, you know, maybe two laps with a pit stop to change tires at race power at 220 kilowatts. And obviously if you progress through, you go to 250 kilowatts. So a lot of the focus is done on, you know, the 220 kilowatts to try and, you know, optimize the group stages. It's made the group stages extremely tight because, you know, most drivers get two shots at the cherry to try and progress through. And I think what we've seen a big difference between the, not only it being a lot fairer between, you know, compared to the previous format is, you know, some drivers in the past were very, very strong at going out and executing that lap on the first lap. And now, you know, some drivers are getting two shots at a slightly lower power. So that just naturally brings the field closer, and some of the margins are just you know, scary how close they are. So it's made qualifying, I would say, a lot fairer, but obviously a lot closer and a lot more stressful. So but I've really enjoyed it. I think it's been a great addition. I think it's very engaging for people. It's very exciting, you know, obviously with the, you know, the format with, you know, the duels with the knockout stages. So I only can say positive things about it. You know, it's not always worked out for us as a team, but I think for a championship, it's been a big support. I think it's really difficult for the championship. You know, we got different power levels, and you know, we're not sort of as tire focused. You know, with compared to other championships with different, you know, multiple tire sets and different compounds and stuff. So to try and get something that sort of works, that's kind of fair and, you know, gives everyone a good shot is not easy. So I think we've found a good compromise this year. And I hope everyone, you know, that has been following Formula E since the start has seen, you know, a good step up from, you know, from a, you know, race day format with the addition of the new qualifying format. So I'm a big fan of it.
Sam, you mentioned that clash between Degrassi and Jev. Obviously in the first race he was taken out with some damage from the opening lap. Is he out of the championship fight now?
No chance. No way is he. He had a really poor weekend, that's for sure. You can't deny that. He looked a bit jaded at the weekend. I don't know why that was. Other drivers have been doing the triple header, Marrakesh, Monza and New York, but yeah, he just looked a little out of sorts at the weekend. He got caught out by that brief shower on Saturday in qualifying, as others did. Then he got hit in that concertina effect at the start with, you know, Mitch had some contact with him, but everything just stopped and some got off lightly more likely than others. Then on Sunday, he made a mistake in qualifying, hit the wall, started way down the grid, 18th, I think it was. And then he had that scrap with Degrassi for the, you know, for the final few points. It was just a messy one. And to be honest, my take on it was that the incident, as I said, you know, Jeff did give Lucas some room more than Lucas gave Jeff some room. So if there was going to be a penalty, I think, again, just reiterating that I was surprised that there wasn't anything in that. Neither of them turned up to the media pen, so we didn't get their takes immediately. But it is known that Jeff stormed out of the office of the office of the stewards when it became known it was going to be a racing incident. So it all got a bit dramatic there. He left the circuit shortly after, so we didn't get his version of events. But anyway, it's over and done now. You know, it was a bad end to a pretty wretched weekend. Again, you know, just in terms of the sort of consistency of how the penalties are applied, I think, you know, Jeff has been quite vocal in his concern about some of the consistency with the decisions that are made. And, you know, I have some sympathy for him on that. With all due respect to Pedro Lamy, who's a fantastic driver and highly decorated sports car driver and has raced at the highest level in F1, he's never sat in an FE car. He's never been, as far as I know, an active driver within Formula E at all. And he's not an active international driver anymore too. You know, he's pretty much retired. I find the whole driver advisory selection a bit strange, to be honest. So, and we've, you know, I've written that several times. I think that needs to be looked at going into Gen 3. I tend to think a permanent or a couple of permanent driver advisors would be the way to go. It just doesn't make a whole load of sense for me to have some of these drivers filling that role. But we'll see. I think that would be a good part of Gen 3 going forward.
Now, Mitch, you're part of this 3 or 4-way title fight and been racing wheel to wheel with Jeff for many seasons now. How do you see it? Is he still part of that battle, or is it just down to the three of you now?
Totally. He's definitely part of it. There's still a lot of points up for grabs. You know, these double headers can throw things up pretty quickly, for good or bad. So, you know, there's, you know, 100 plus points still up for grabs. So, obviously he's had a tough weekend. But, look, you know, one of us could easily have a tough weekend in London or in Seoul. So, look, he's still within striking distance. And I think any of us that are still within striking distance, you know, coming into the last race, you know, probably into Seoul, you know, we've got a good shot. So he'll be there. He'll fight back. He's been strong all year. You know, DS have been very strong, especially in qualifying. So, you know, I'm expecting him to fight back next weekend in London.
So talking of DS Cheetah, they ended a long win drought as Antonio Felix da Costa took the win in race 2 to end 14 months without a win, Sam. But it was a consummate performance from him.
Yeah, it was. I think da Costa has been back to somewhere near his best since probably around Monaco, I think. It was a major surprise that he wasn't really at the races in the first sort of 3 events of the season, or as much as you expect him to be at the front. But, you know, a driver of his quality will always come good, and he's proved that in recent events. He was helped a little bit by Alexander Sims and De Vries as well, to some extent, with been sort of corks in the bottle, so to speak, in the Sunday race, and getting that gap on, being able to get a little gap to Van Dorn and Mitch too. But still, I think he had it reasonably under control. He had a lot of pace on Sunday, and it told. He's now won at Monaco and New York, arguably Formula E's 2 prestige events. So it's a decent return as his DS Cheetah stint comes to a close. He celebrated, I noted, by taking a dip in the Hudson. I reckon if he does that in London and does the same in the Thames, you know, I think...
He's not going to Seoul.
He's definitely not going to Seoul, and he's not getting through doping control, is he? So let's hope he's sensible and doesn't continue the aquatic exploits in the Thames. Yeah,
Mitch, you had an action-packed drive to third. It looked like a lot of fun for where I'm sitting, but do you think you could have won it if Sims hadn't put up such a strong defence?
Honestly, I think I would have given it a good go. I had the car speed to win, I think, and I never really, and I've said this publicly, I never say this lightly, and even in our debrief, you know, I'm very honest and realistic with, you know, how I feel paces during the race. And this is one of the races where I felt like I had the car to win. Obviously we'll never know, but yeah, I just obviously started a little bit further back compared to Antonio, but I also sat on the dirty side of the track, which I then lost position to Jake Dennis at the start. And, you know, so obviously I had to, you know, progress through, I had to use my tire up a bit more to get him, Sete Camara, De Vries, and then De Vries sort of was the one that I would say, you know, made life a lot harder for me. And you know, obviously Sims was there on merit. He did a great job on Sunday. He knocked me out of the jewels. You know, he was there, you know, on genuine pace. And then obviously he was hanging on. He was a little bit down at energy and I think slightly, you know, compromised with battery temp. So he was more on the defense and offense. And I was coming at him pretty quick, but he defended well. And I feel like if I cleared him, the battle between us three would have been pretty intense. So I guess we'll never know, but I feel like I had the pace to that I was maybe slightly stronger than the guys ahead. Because once I had the, you know, obviously the big moment with the bump, you know, I lost, you know, a lot of time and I pretty much made it all back. So the car was working well. So but obviously I was super happy to see Antonio get his first win. I would have liked to be part of that fight towards the end of the race.
Sam, we should talk about the previous points leader, Edo Mantara. He slipped down after a pretty scrappy weekend by his recent standards.
Yeah, it was. And it broke up some momentum he'd got from Berlin, Jakarta and Marrakesh, where he was magnificent. It hurt him big time. He had a 14-point lead over Van Dorn heading into the Big Apple, but he's now 11 points behind him. So a big swing there just at the wrong time of the season. He actually raced really well, to be fair, at the weekend, along with Mitch and Robin Fries. Was unlucky on Saturday that the race wasn't restarted, although, you know, he did need some attention to his car after his own moment in the wall of water. So but he got a penalty for spiking over the 50 kph rule, as Mitch mentioned earlier, under the full course yellow, which dropped him from fifth to ninth. So he lost some points there, which was a mistake on his part, although, you know, has to be caveated by the appalling conditions, of course. Then a day later he grabbed a point, got a point for 10th, which was a tiny bit of damage limitation after some chronic brake by wire issues in practice and qualifying. So overall, yeah, bad weekend, but I have a feeling he'll be strong again in London. I think he's shown this season in the more hierarchical qualifying format that he's always there. And there's plenty of low speed corners at London as well. So I'd say his style and the way that he's super good on those slow speed parts of tracks, that he can head to London reasonably confident that it was just a blip and he'll be back in contention for a title fight with Mitch and Stoffel and obviously Jev as well, a resurgent Jev. I actually think that if you can head to Seoul within 12 points of whoever the leader is going into Seoul, you're in the game. You know, you're up for it. And I think as long as you stay within that bracket, then anything's possible at a completely new challenge in Seoul. So, so much to look forward to.
Right, I think it's time for a few honourable mentions. Mitch, in race two, your teammate Sam Bird drove a brilliant charge in drive, making up over a dozen places to take fifth. He needed that result, didn't he?
Yeah, he had an amazing race, actually. You know, both cars are working really well. And you know, we know what Sam's like in the races. He's one of the best overtakers out there. He's always very strong. Unfortunately, just in quali, he couldn't, you know, after being quickest in FP3, he couldn't put it together as much as he would have liked. I think he got caught out a bit with Jeff hitting the wall and couldn't complete his lap properly. So he started out of position, but had a storming drive. Because after I had my moment with the pothole, I saw my mirrors. He was right there. So I was like, okay, this is good. And you know, obviously he's had a bit of a up and down season, and and he's aware of that. And you know, this result, I think Sunday as a whole was, obviously aside from qualifying, it was a really positive day for him. And you know, with a guy like Sam, only takes one result like that, and he'll be back to his best. And I think we saw that. So I'm looking forward to seeing what he can do. Obviously, we're in a teams fight as well with the top guys and the team championships. So, hopefully, for next weekend and so he can be up the front scoring some big points for the team. But it was great to see him get fifth on the weekend.
Excellent. Sam, you did a fantastic interview with Alexander Sims, which you can find on the-race.com. And that drive to fourth was a timely reminder of just what a good driver he is.
Absolutely was. He drove a great race. But it's, equally, it's very frustrating at the same time for lots of reasons, mainly because, as he said in that interview, when things do come together with that Mahindra, they don't know why. The inconsistency in getting to the sweet spot of it just must be maddening for him and Roland this season. This weekend, it was Roland who really wasn't in the game. He just didn't seem to be there at all. And on Sunday, Sims he was, and he was mega. Really, really quick, really strong, raced really efficiently. And I thought he deserved a podium for what he did. He didn't quite achieve that, but still a very strong showing. The interview I did with him in Marrakesh kind of outlined some of those things, as I said, and in a sense, they just can't seem to understand how that Mahindra works and why it works and more often than not doesn't quite work on race pace. I think that reflects a lot of teams actually outside the top four. If we take the top four of Jags, DS, Merck and Venturi, which I think has been the case this season, like Mahindra, the true midfield of them, Porsche, Envision and Andretti, it's just been so scatty in terms of them getting big points. That's the difference between mounting a championship campaign, isn't it? Race in, race out for strong points this season while minimising the bad days. It's only those four top teams that have really minimised those bad days. Jags have had one in Mexico, Venturi in Rome, but they've been able to actually not have, they have very few of those days. Whereas the midfield bunch, although quick on occasion and winning on occasion, as Envision have proved, and Porsche, just don't have the consistency, and it's all about that this season. So, but Simsy, Simsy certainly, I think, shows that he is certainly, he should be in Formula E, and I think it'll be a big miss that he isn't there. But he's had a couple of very tough seasons, and explained some of the reasons why in his interview, which was was just terrific. Just allowing somebody to speak their mind on a difficult decision is what we enjoy doing. So, but it'll be very sad to see him go.
Other noteworthy performances included Sebastian Buemi taking sixth for one of Nissan's best results of the season, and Jake Dennis bagging a pair of eights for Andretti. Sam, we also saw Sergio Sette Camera qualify season best fifth for Dragon Penske. Even ran in the points for quite a large chunk of the race, but ultimately any hopes for a first top 10 of the season for him and the team faded away.
Yeah, I know it goes to script, doesn't it? I mean, some one-lap pace, but Dragon ultimately just not having the capability to put a race together, and it plays out on the track, race in, race out. You have to feel sympathy for the team, for the staffers there, and also for the drivers, really. Bit of a hiding to nothing. How often have we used that phrase this year for Dragon Penske? I thought Sete Câmara was mega throughout the weekend, although he did blot his copybook on Saturday. But when that happens and he misjudged the final corner, he's absolutely wringing that thing's neck. He's on it. So he ends up looking a bit foolish, but actually without taking those chances, he's not going anywhere. So you got to feel for him on that respect. One lap pace, will get you a headline grab for a few hours, but in 2022 Formula E, that's about it. I think actually what Formula E races now show is actually how poor that car is. It highlights the fact so clearly that it is so far away from the rest, and it just must be so depressing for them to realise that's going to play out over a race. There isn't much good to say about that team, and it isn't the team in the sense of the people who work for it, the people who are driving for it. It's just what they have delivered in that car, and they're really going nowhere. I just hope that Sete Câmara gets a chance to be on the grid for next season. It'd be good to see him in something other than that car. hopefully Giovinazzi can reshape his career. I'm sure he will elsewhere in 23 as well, because frankly, at the moment, they're just wasting their time with that car.
Now, Mitch, it appears that was probably the last race we're going to have in Red Hook. Is it a track you're going to miss?
Oh, massively. I think the whole event itself is one of those, the ones you look forward to, right? I mean, New York City, it's one of the most insane cities in the world. To have the privilege to race here is amazing. I think that, you know, it's quite a quirky little track, very tight, twisty, but always seems to throw up some drama, as we saw on the weekend. But even historically, it's always been like quite an entertaining race, even though it's, you know, on paper, it's actually not one of the, it's relatively difficult to overtake. Obviously it's not on the calendar for next year as of today. So that brings definitely some sadness. Maybe they can find some solutions to that. But I think for everyone that, you know, that's part of the championship enjoys going there. You know, it's in Brooklyn, but, you know, New York has got so much to offer, and it's really a highlight event for the championship. So if we can't go back there, hopefully we can stay stateside somewhere in another big city, like in Miami or the West Coast would be incredible. But to lose New York would be a real shame.
Sam, how are things looking on the US race front for next season?
Some options have been explored. Obviously, the chief one is to try and somehow make continue at Red Hook. But I think the chances, from what I gauged in the paddock, are kind of 50-50 at the minute, whether they can do that for next year. What we did reveal on the hyphen race last week was that St. Petersburg, the IndyCar circuit, is being looked at as one possibility for next season, probably the weekend after the IndyCar race in March. So it could take that TBD slot, which we presume was for Sanya, if we could go to China. But that looked...
I thought that was really interesting when you broke that news, Sam, because I went to the IndyCar race this year and I came back saying this would be absolutely perfect for Formula E. It doesn't have the cachet of New York, absolutely not. But in terms of the town, absolutely gets it, right? Everywhere turns into a place where race fans are hanging out, they're spilling out onto the streets, and there's a genuinely great vibe about it. It's quite a small place, but I think the nature and layout of the track would be ideal for Formula E. Maybe it just doesn't have enough kudos, but I think if they could pull that off, it would be a really decent substitute.
Yeah, I agree. And even if it is just for a season, just to tidy us over in the States, I mean, the clear thing is Formula E absolutely needs to be in the US at least one race, ideally two. I think California is the holy grail for Formula E for lots of reasons. Not the least that the EV industry is, or big part of the global EV industry is in California. So, St. Pete's would be great next year. But at the same time, I enjoy going to New York so much. It would be a big shame not to be in Brooklyn. But we'll have to see. I'm told that there are options, but St. Petersburg certainly is one of the options. Michael Andretti told us last Friday that he'd be quite happy to have that IndyCar and Formula E double header, not at the same event, but the week after, and it would all work quite nicely. So it would, I think, if they can get that together next March, it would then see how that goes, and then look at options further down the line.
Cool. Well, fingers crossed for that. So looking forward now, Mitch, London next up, home race for Jaguar Racing. I'm sure they'll have lots of guests in tow. So what are your thoughts ahead of that one?
Yeah, I mean, London obviously was the first time we went there last year. It's a big one for us, home race for the team, which is always important to try and do well. But obviously now with the tension building up with the championship, you know, adds that extra element to it. Everyone in the company, you know, I'm actually at HQ right now up in Gaydon to see employees and some of the senior management here. So everyone's pumped up, and obviously with the race coming up next weekend, everyone's very excited. It's another quirky location and circuit with the element of going indoor outdoor, big surface differences in terms of grip levels, some modifications as well to the track. We've lost those two very tight hairpins, which I think is a good move. So yeah, I'm on the sim tomorrow for that, and I'm looking forward to getting out there and obviously trying to continue our run of form. So yeah, last year we got a podium. We seemed quite competitive, so hopefully we can obviously continue that. So yeah, a big weekend. I think it's gonna be a big turnout. Another big event for Formula E. So looking forward to it.
They've made a couple of tweaks to the layout of the track, especially those sort of seemed like about 20 hairpins that led onto one another. What do you make of the changes?
Yeah, I'm yet to drive it on the sim. That'll be tomorrow. But from what I've seen, I think it's definitely the right move. You know, I think, yes, hairpins should be able to create overtaking, but just the way they were sort of designed, it just seemed a bit extreme. And even to drive, like on one lap, it just seemed a bit over the top. So it created a lot of carnage, you know, with these cars and quite a long nose. When you get quite an aggressive radius like those two hairpins, it's very easy to make contact, as you see in most races, but I think those were particularly bad. So, yeah, I'll have to come back to you in terms of what the changes are like because I've not actually driven on the sim yet. So, but as from what I've seen, it looks positive, which is really encouraging, and hopefully it just produces good racing. And for us as drivers, it's enjoyable to drive.
Now, Sam, we've barely mentioned that Stoffel Vandoorne has now taken the points lead across this podcast. He was fast but unlucky in London last year. Is he the man to beat?
He's one of them. Yeah, I mean, his New York was, although obviously involved in the shunt on Saturday, I think on Sunday that second place that he got was again one of those drives where, you know, you could appraise it at the end of the season and look and go, you know, they rebuilt his car, they changed the tub, he still got a second place and he was still solid and brought home big points, got a big swing on Moltar in particular. And I'm loath to put favorite tags on any of those four that we've mentioned, but I think Vandoorne was good in London last season and got wiped out by Oliver Rowland, didn't he? And you know, you simply don't know what's going to happen at London with this unique inside and outside at the Accelerine. I mean, it's easy, isn't it, to get four seasons in one day in terms of the weather in London this time of season. So we'll have to see. But yeah, Vandoorne, I think, is somebody who could emerge from London with a healthy points lead. But as I, you know, reverting back to what I said before, I see that sort of 10-12 point buffer not unassailable going into a double header in Seoul in a few weeks' time.
Well, I think that's a great way to wrap up the show. A huge thanks to Mitch for joining us. We wish you all the very best of luck for the rest of the season. I'm actually about to go on holidays, which means I'm going to miss the London race and the next podcast. But fear not, listener, we've got a great replacement lined up. Some might say considerably better, but I'll leave that to you to be the judge of. Keep an eye on the-race.com for Sam's latest paddock news, and stay safe in the heat. Goodbye.
The Athletic.